Psalm 96. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord, praise his name. Proclaim his salvation day after day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous deeds among all peoples. For great is the Lord and most worthy of praise. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the nations are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and glory are his sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, all you families of the nations. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. The world is firmly established. It cannot be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens rejoice. Let the earth be glad. Let the sea resound and all that is in it. Let the fields be jubilant and everything in them. Let all the trees of the forest sing for joy. Let all creation rejoice before the Lord, for he comes. He comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness.
All right. Well, not only are we singing new songs tonight, we are also trying something new, which is the collaborative sermon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it went great.
I think so.
We'll just try it again.
We were watching duos today on YouTube to get a feel for how this should go. And the best I could come up with was the Hurley He Boy with Chris Farley and Adam Sandler, you know, where he's like, the Hurley He Boy is like asking permission to watch your house.
Let me take in your mail.
And then it just pans over to Chris Farley. He's like, let the boy take your mail. So I thought that would be appropriate role, like whatever Tim says, then I'll yell at you and tell you to listen to him. Listen to him!
So we're doing this. There's actually two reasons. One's real practical and then one's more important. The practical reason is that my wife's due Wednesday, and so we had no idea if I would be here this Sunday, right? So we needed to figure out something that could be flexible and that just got Josh could do if I weren't here. But even more importantly, Psalm 96, this is a psalm about prayer through song, praying through songs. And Josh is obviously the Bible teacher, but a singer-songwriter as well. And so we thought, oh, he should do it. He was like, I want to do it. And then Psalm 96 has all these really cool Old Testament kind of Hebrew words and concepts and background. And I was like, no, I want to do it. And so then we were like, let's just do it together. So there you go. So there you have it. There you have it. We're continuing in our Psalm series. This is part of our 90-day challenge, you recall, if you've been around. So this is like day 36 or 37, depending on if you started on a Sunday or a Monday, of the challenge. And part of this is about inviting the whole church into an experience to cultivate the habit of daily connecting with God through prayer, using the language of the scriptures. And there's a whole book of the Bible that's there to give us the language of prayer. That is the book of Psalms. And so we've been highlighting different prayers or songs and what they teach us about how to pray and how to talk to God. And tonight we're exploring Psalm 96, which is a prayer entirely about singing. And not just singing, but praying through our singing. And I sat down and thought about this. There aren't that many social settings where we get together like we do, not just on a weekly basis, but period. There's not too many places where we get together with a whole bunch of other people and sing the same songs together. Like, really, how often do you do that kind of thing other than right here together with the community of Christians here at Door of Hope? And so I was thinking there's Timbers games where there's a whole lot of people saying the same thing together. Right? Or chanting a lot of things. What they're doing is cussing out the other team, right? And so there's that, or Blazers games. There's also maybe a concert where there's a whole bunch, maybe the artist is so well known that everybody knows the words of the song, so everybody's singing along. But what we're doing here is different. because we don't just think we're singing out because we're enjoying it. We actually think we're, or at least we should think, that we are singing to someone who's not standing up here, but who's present here in our midst. There's nowhere else we really do this kind of thing. And so it just raises the question, if you've been in the church for a long time, maybe you were raised going to church, why do we sing? And you're like, well, we just sing because we've always done it, I guess, at church or whatever. And then there's a whole bunch of you at Door of Hope who are new to the faith, and you're like, why do we sing? I've never been a part of anything like this before. Maybe you like it, or maybe you don't like it. I don't know, but you don't know what to do with it. And so Psalm 96 is one of a number of psalms in the book that explore this question of why do we sing and why prayer through song is such an important part of being a Christian. So the poem, it has four movements to it. And so we're going to kind of tag team through the four movements. And here you go. You guys ready for action? Okay. Look at the first line of the poem with me. It says, sing to the Lord a new song. And look at the calls. There's five calls to a group of people here in this first movement, verses 1, 2, 3. It says, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, praise his name. Proclaim his salvation day after day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous deed among the peoples. There's six calls here. Sing, 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 praise, proclaim, declare. Do you see it there? The six different calls to do something when we all gather together. And the first thing that we're called to sing is a new song. Sing a new song. Now this little phrase, this is super interesting. It occurs just 9 times throughout the whole Bible. And every time it occurs, it's used to describe someone's response to a new experience they've had of God's salvation or his mercy, his grace, his healing, his rescue in some way. And new songs, then, are always supposed to be kind of flowing out of a life of faith and a life of someone on the journey of faith as we continue to experience new instances of God's salvation in our lives. The first worship song in the Bible, did you know this? The first worship song, this is good Bible trivia, great at a party to know, right? So what's the first song in the Bible in terms of the storyline? It's right after the Israelites are rescued out of slavery in Egypt. It's in the book of Exodus, right? And they cross through the sea. It's a famous storyline on dry land. And the moment they pass through, the waters crash in on their murderous oppressors, the Egyptians. And what's the first thing they do when the free Israelites step foot onto dry land into their new future? It's the first thing they do, right? Look at the words here for Exodus chapter 15. It says, then Moses and the Israelites, they sang a song. That's what they did. They sang a song to the Lord. They said, I will sing to the Lord. He's highly exalted. Both horse and driver, he's hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength. He's my defense. He's become my salvation. He is my God. I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will exalt him. And so this is very typical throughout the story of the Bible, to be a part of the people of God, the God revealed to us in the scriptures, is to be a people who respond in song. And that's what God's people have been up to from the very beginning. A new act of God's grace, a new act of his salvation, we sing new songs. New songs are a sign of vitality. They're a sign of health because there's new things happening, new people experiencing God's grace in new ways. If there aren't new songs being produced, I think according to Psalm 96, we should be asking what's going on. Is anybody having a new experience in here that should generate something creative and something beautiful to you, good sir?
And I would just state that, you know, the scriptures are very clear that God's people, when we gather, this is a place in which we begin with song because we're called to enter into his presence with singing. And the question of why we sing is directly connected to God himself. He commands us to sing, and we must remember that anything that God asks of us, the rule of thumb is he does not ask anything of us that is not first true of himself. And you may ask the question, are you saying that God is a singing God? And that is exactly what I'm saying. In fact, in Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 17, these words are declared through the prophet, the Lord your God is with you,
the mighty warrior who saves. He will take great delight in you. In his love, he will no longer rebuke you, but will rejoice over you with singing. Isn't that a beautiful verse? There aren't many verses that declare God as a singing God, but this verse does. And whenever we see scenes of the angelic hosts around the throne of God, what are they doing? They're singing, they're praising God. Even the examples that Tim used, the very few examples of where large groups of people are together, singing together, they're engaging in acts of worship. I mean, that's what they're doing. It's just the quality of the worship is dependent upon what you're worshiping. And so when we come together, we are doing what is the natural expression of the human heart. In fact, it is the language of the heart. Music is. I would argue that music is the universal language. You know, one of my first experiences of song crossing language barriers was going on my first trip to Russia and performing with a band that I used to be a part of called Telecast, and performing in front of 1,000 Russians, singing in English. But there was just something, there was just a connectivity that was occurring. And their hearts, it was like the music transcended the language barrier. There was a connectivity that happened. And I think that even in the corporate gathering of the church, that music is a universal language. I heard a preacher once say that the relationship between the pastor and the worship leader is that of a surgery team, that the worship leader prepares the heart for surgery so that when the word is declared and preached, the heart is ready. And he goes, I don't know how that's done. He goes, but I can tell you, I know when it's been done wrong. And I think that there is something to that. There's a call for us as God's people that we are expressing what the heart does not know how to express in just normal conversation. Music is our ability to express those interior, incommunicable longings of the human heart, and those longings that we have to be united with God. Because there's something about the words being connected with melody that gives us it is the right place. I always like to say this: song in the church gathering is the right place to feel deeply. It's the right place to feel deeply. So not only is it the language of the heart, that language of the heart is something that is difficult to describe, but we all know it. It becomes an elusive thing to explain. I've been reading this Brazilian author who's deceased. Her name's Clarice Lispector, and in her book Água Viva, which means living water in Portuguese, she writes this. She says, "What I say to you is never what I say to you, but something else instead. It captures the thing that escapes me, and yet I live from it." And she's talking about song, how she writes songs, and she's like, what I'm saying isn't necessarily what I'm saying, but the song captures what I meant, that I couldn't just say to you in words. And I think that is a profound thing. But not only that, this call to sing a new song is also a call to fresh wind and fresh fire. It's not so much just a new composition, but it's coming each week with this desire and this expectation that not only will we experience God in our song as the reflection of that experience, but that we will experience God in the moment that we're expressing our worship to Him. It's an expectation. It's a belief that God's mercies are new every day. Therefore, our worship is not to be stale. It's not to be introverted. It is to be expressive. It is to be outward. It is to be new every time we sing it. A song can be new even if it's been sung 100 times if the heart is right before our King. Although I do believe, as Tim said, that it also is about God raising up. I believe there should be a new expression of worship that is reflective of what God is doing for each generation. It's that this unique language that we have as the church put within the constraints of the language of the day. And so I think that there is a call to speak the new these new songs and to sing them. But I think finally, this new song is an act of faith. To sing to a God that you cannot see is an act of faith. And it is why it is so compelling to those who do not know Christ that come and visit the church. I've seen again and again, people have come to me and they said that aren't even believers, but when they hear the church singing together, they're moved to tears. I had a buddy, Ronnie Feist, who when he first started coming around the church, he came up to me after about the third week and he says, he called me PJ for Pastor Josh. He's like, PJ. He goes, this thing happens when you're singing. I'm like, what? And he's like, what does that mean? And he's like, you cry? And he goes, yeah, what is that about? And he's being stirred. There's a longing in his heart. He recognizes his need. He sees the community of faith gathered around something they believe so passionately in. And so it becomes an act of faith. It becomes an experience in which when Jesus said, when two or more gathered in my name, I am in the midst of them. I think that his presence is experienced in a unique fashion when we sing. So there's my thoughts on that. Back to you, Tim.
Yeah, yeah. Look, so we're riffing on the new song here. And it's both about new music being produced, but also connecting ourselves with generations before us, but experiencing Jesus in a new way. Look at verse 2. It's the same kind of this new and old, this experience dynamic. It comes out in verse 2 in a big way. So we're called to sing in verse 2. Sing, praise. And we think, oh yeah, song, praise, worship, or whatever. What's the third call in verse 2? Do you see it there? What is it? Proclaim. Proclaim. And verse 3, declare. Now, this is very interesting because we think of declaring or proclaiming something as just talking, right? Or maybe yelling, right? And somehow, in the conception of the poet here, song, at least song, new songs sung to the Lord, are a form of proclamation. They are a declaration. And this is even brought more home by the word, the Hebrew word that the author uses here. You'll kind of see it up here on the screen. That word proclaim. I'm going to geek out for a second here. So that word proclaim is the Hebrew word basar, which you probably never heard of before, basar. But when the early Christians and when Christianity went out into the Greek-speaking world, and they brought the Old Testament with them, they translated its concepts and its ideas into Greek, and the Greek word that corresponded to this Hebrew concept of proclaiming, basar, was the Greek word euangelizo. Euangelizo. What English word comes from that word right there? To evangelize, evangelism, evangelical, which has unfortunately gotten hijacked to have a political meaning. But the most basic meaning is good news, to tell good news, to proclaim it, to share it, to announce it, and we might even say to preach. And so this is very important. This is kind of highlighting of what this, when a new generation experiences God's grace and salvation in a new way, what is that issue in? It issues in song, the language of the heart. But these songs are not just about what we feel. So think back to, you know, the first few weeks of the series. We looked at Psalms of praying through fear, praying through our pain and our grief. So this is about telling God what's happening to me and how I feel about it. That's super important. But when we sing, that can't be the only thing we sing about. This is like what's happening to me and how I feel about it. There's a moment of declaration where we say what's true. There are some times when we come and we gather to sing and I feel like singing. I have things that I can think of and experience of God's grace. I want to sing. There are some times where we come to sing and I don't feel like it at all. But it's very important then the discipline of singing as proclamation, singing as announcement of what's true regardless of how I feel about it. And so here this leads us into the second movement. What is it that we're proclaiming? What is the good news that we declare? And that's part of what the rest of the poem is about. Let's look at this issues us right into the second movement of the poem. It starts in verse 4. Here's the content of this declaration. In our song, we declare, verse 4, great is the Lord. And just to remind you or note for some of you, when you see the word Lord there in all capital letters, that's your translator's giving you a clue there. Underneath that is, in Hebrew, is the divine personal name. Yahweh. It's his personal covenant name that he gave to his people. And so great is Yahweh, most worthy of praise. He is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the nations are idols, but Yahweh, he's the one who made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and glory are in his sanctuary. So song is a way of sharing the good news about the specific God that we worship. And in the Old Testament, he's revealed to us as Yahweh. And again, as Christians, we receive this in light of the kind of the full story of what the Bible is saying, and Jesus' own claim that he was Yahweh become human to do for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. And so our songs need to have balanced this element of sharing how we feel, but also saying what's true about the specific God that we worship. People should hear the songs being sung by followers of Jesus and walk away with a very clear vision of who we're singing to and who and why we're singing to him. Our songs should be about the unique traits and character traits of what Yahweh revealed to us as Jesus has done. And so our songs are a way of sharing the gospel. That's why we do Church in the Park, because the songs themselves tell the story. And so that's very important for us at Door of Hope, is that our songs aren't just about God. They're about Jesus, God. They're about the name of this Jesus of Nazareth, who is God to us, who was the human. He lived as the kind of human that you and I wish we could be most of the time. Maybe not all the time. We wish we could be, but can never become because we're so screwed up and selfish and self-focused. He died to absorb the pain and the sin and the evil of our world into himself so that he could conquer it by rising from the dead, so he can offer us his grace and his life and power and a chance to become new and different kinds of humans and to be rescued. Mm-hmm. That's the content of the Jesus that we sing about. And we should ask no questions, have no questions in our mind about who we're singing to when we gather. And so the very important part of the new song is that it's a form of sharing the gospel.
Yeah, and as Tim was speaking, you know, it reminded me of, like, is that balance of what we feel combined with who we know God to be as he's revealed himself through his scriptures. That's kind of the power of the worship experience, because even the psalms that express deep emotion, they're always anchored in the truth of who God has revealed himself to be. And I think that's an essential part. It's a beautiful thing that our greatest freedoms come also through our boundaries. And I think that our worship experiences, there's a proper boundaries, or if you will, parameters put on our worship so that we can express fully what we feel, but it's anchored upon the truth of who God is through Jesus Christ. You know, when I write worship songs and when I talk with worship leaders, it's very important that we are confined by this reality that we are to be a people that declare the name of Christ. And I always say that worship should be Christ-centric. And there's been kind of this fresh wave of worship over the last 30 years. It kind of began with the Jesus movement, is where the birth of contemporary worship came out of. But over the years, that worship has become increasingly ambiguous. About who it's about, where you'll sing a song, you're like, is that for someone's girlfriend or who is that for? And now I've always been a fan. I'm a bit of a mystic, so like worship songs that have an intimate sense, where it's so intimate that if you don't really know Jesus, it'll make you uncomfortable. But it still try to be Christ-centric in it. Even when we're using the Psalms, which are a great source of inspiration for worship leaders, we need to remember that we have a fuller revelation than the Psalms, because Jesus himself spoke himself in. He said, hey, listen, these things actually are pointing to me. So he kind of gives the fill even to how we interpret the Old Testament. And so our worship as a people, if it's God, if it's first upward toward God, it's upward toward God through Jesus, but it's also outward toward men, because Jesus says, if I be lifted up, I will draw all people unto himself. And this is a powerful call, guys. This shows that the preaching of the gospel is not primarily mine and Tim's responsibility, but that when we sing together, you are actually partaking not only in your own heart expression of to God, but you are actually engaging in preaching. We preach Christ crucified, is what Paul declared. Every time we sing a song that celebrates the cross and celebrates our Savior, and when we connect it with what we feel, what's powerful about that is it takes it out of mere theology. And it brings it into its theology, which is meant to feed the personal, because our whole faith is built on the idea that God is someone, and that he is someone that can be known.
Song is part of the way in which we know him and make him known. And I think that that's very important for us to remember when we're singing.
That was great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Josh.
I felt the same about yours.
So let's kind of get the flow of the poem.
Listen to him.
As we got into that. The third movement starts in verse 7. But again, get the flow. We're called to sing a new song because of a new experience. It's a new expression. And as we do that, we're proclaiming the uniqueness of who Jesus is in distinction from all other religious options on the table, of which there are many in America and the city of Portland. And what does that move us to? Verse 7, this new movement. It says, "Ascribe to Yahweh, all you families of the nations. Ascribe to Yahweh glory and strength. Ascribe to Yahweh the glory that's due his name. Bring an offering, come into his courts. Worship Yahweh in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, Yahweh, he reigns. The world is firmly established. It cannot be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity." So you almost kind of have to close your eyes here as you see these and depict the scene. Psalm 96 is depicting a scene that would be familiar to you if you've read through the Old Testament prophets in like Isaiah chapter 2 or Jeremiah 23. It's this vision that at the culmination of history, when Yahweh makes all things right, when he judges the peoples with equity, it'll be like this mass gathering of the nations to acknowledge who Yahweh truly is as our creator, the redeemer, and the just judge, to be the one who can really wrap history up in a way that's just and good and right. And so there's a number of things. The imagery and the poetry of the psalm depicts this. It's almost like a courtroom scene is what you're meant to think of. But the one sitting at the judge's seat is this benevolent king. It's Yahweh who reigns, and all of the nations come to offer gifts and worship and so on. I want to highlight one thing, and there's lots of things we could highlight here, but verse 7, I think, has one of the most profound things going on in this movement. Who is it that's called to come ascribe to Yahweh, which means to declare about him? Who's called to do this? Look at verse 7, and it says, "Families of the nations." Now, notice the poet is very selected in his wording here. He could just say nations, couldn't he, Josh?
He could have.
But he didn't, right? He says, "Families of nations." Families of nations. And just stop and think that through. What's the difference between just saying all nations and families of nations? And again, let me geek out for a second here, because that's what I do, but I hope to always make it interesting and intriguing to
listen to him.
Right here. So this, the word family here, also has one of the Hebrew letters that forces you to clear your throat. When you say the word, which is great. You end up with a very clear throat if you read the Hebrew Bible aloud, because it has the cha sound there. It's mishpacha. Why don't you say it with me? Mishpacha. So mishpacha, in the Old Testament, there's nations, which is about a political entity. There's people groups, peoples, which is about ethnic identity. Your mishpacha is the equivalent in our culture of your last name. So not your given name, but your surname. It's your tribe. It's your clan. It's the family from which you come. And so the poet's very, very clear. He's trying to emphasize something here. This is a mass gathering of humanity, but the emphasis is on all of the families. It's on the diversities. The diversity of this mass of humanity. Every type of mishpacha is represented here, all bringing their unique offering of thanksgiving, a new song declaring who Yahweh is. So there's a unified purpose, one God, one Jesus, but all these different stories and tribes and clans that are bringing their uniqueness. So just think about what's happening here. This is about new songs are about bringing unity to all these different stories of how we experience Jesus. And so just think of like the makeup of a room like this one right here. So like some of you grew up around church, around the faith or whatever. Some of you didn't grow up around that at all, and you're totally brand new to the faith. Some of you grew up in very stable homes, with parents who have a very stable marriage. Some of you grew up in just the opposite. Maybe both of your parents weren't on the scene, no stability whatsoever. Some of you have a pretty stable life right now, a decent job, steady income. Some of us just came through battles with addiction. Some of us were living on the streets not long ago. Some of us just in general are feeling good about our lives. Some of us are in places of real hardship. What on earth could unite and be a common factor between all those various types of stories, those various types of mishpacha? Exactly. There's only one thing. There's only one thing. And so the unity that we experience in worship, the symbolic embodied experience of all singing the same thing and to the same Jesus, it's literally this diversity of who we are, bringing all of our diverse stories and experiences to one focal point. We're proclaiming that the one Jesus of Nazareth can speak and address the needs and the pains and the joys of every type of 7 billion human stories that are on the planet right now. That's what we're doing. And not just symbolically, literally, when we sing, you are out of your story joining your brothers and sisters to focus on this one Jesus. It's a unique and beautiful thing when we're doing that.
You know,
say Libby.
There's a powerful passage, actually, from Dietrich Bonhoeffer in Life Together. And since it was Tim's idea to put it up on the screen, I'm going to put it up there.
I forgot again.
And it's okay.
Sorry.
Because it's a
good quote.
It's a beautiful quote. But Bonhoeffer has this whole section on singing as a community and what it represents for us. But he writes, "Our song on earth is speech. It is the sung word." Now, when he uses that phrase, he's speaking of John 1. He's referencing Jesus himself as the Logos, the living word. "In singing together, it is possible for us to speak and pray the same word at the same time. In other words, because we gather unified in the word, the music is completely the servant of the word." Notice, the music is not the end in and of itself. It serves the proclamation of Jesus. "It elucidates the word in its mystery. All singing together that is right must serve," I love this line, "to widen our spiritual horizon, make us see our little company as one member of the great Christian church on earth." And so here is a powerful picture, as Tim just painted for us, is we as a family, as one tribe amongst a much larger tribe, we being a small church amongst the universal church, we are unified together. And one of the things that we are doing when we sing together, which is why I would argue that it is so important that when you come, that you sing, that you actually lift up your voice and sing with your brothers and sisters, because the power of it is it fulfills the very command of the New Testament, which is that we are to function, even though we are different personalities with different giftings, we make up one body, and Christ is the head. And so when we sing songs together that declare the character of our God and proclaim the gospel, essentially what we're doing is we are singing to God through the lips of Jesus in a very profound and mystical way, because it's the Holy Spirit within us that inspires us and draws us our attention to Christ. But when we sing unified together, that is a revelation of our oneness in spirit, singing this with one voice to our King. It takes us away from a life that's built around what's best for me, and all of a sudden you recognize that you are a part of a much bigger story. You are a part of a much deeper song, a song that is being sung by many around you, that is drawing you in. It's a place where you sense that family, and it is a powerful means of for the world to see our love for one another, our unity in the Spirit. Bonhoeffer actually has this really funny remark that follows on this passage about how he thinks it's wrong. I mean, he's a German Lutheran, so he's coming from a little bit different place than we are. But he wrote about how he felt it was wrong for an individual to not sing in harmony with the rest of the body. So there are people
that I've known at Door of Hope that are very free. They're like, they treat singing like scatting or something. They're like, I don't care what's on this screen. This is the verse that the Lord gave me right now. And it's like, you're always pray to God as a worship leader that person sitting in the back of the church, because it's like, what? Hey, that's not what I'm singing right now. But they're like, but it's, I'm just being led by the Spirit. The Spirit brings unity. At least in song, okay? And that's Bonhoeffer's point. He's like, when you don't sing in unity with the rest of the saints, when there's one voice off doing its own thing, it actually breaks the unity of the gathering. I found that really, so I've shared that before with very specific people in mind. You know who you are. Okay, back to you, Tim.
Okay, big picture here. Let's go through the flow, and we'll go to the fourth movement, which starts in verse 11. So again, I think it's always useful to see, you know, these poems are these beautiful works of craftsmanship. There's this flow to it, a progression through the songs. So we're called to sing these new songs, new expressions that declare the uniqueness of who Yahweh is. As we do so, we unite all the different stories and families of the nations. Look at verse 11. It's so interesting. It says, let the heavens rejoice. Let the earth be glad. Let the sea resound and all that is in it. Let the fields be jubilant and everything that's in them. Let all the trees of the forest sing for joy. Let all creation rejoice before Yahweh, for he's coming. He comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in faithfulness. You look like you really want to say something.
No.
Right now.
No.
Okay. You're just over there giddy.
I was thinking about what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Sorry,
man,
that's
so rich. No,
listen
great,
to him.
So think of, I'll leave the little comment you made in the last service to you because that was a good one, but so I'll say some other comments. So notice the difference here. This was a call. Look at the beginning. It's a call, sing, 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 praise, proclaim, declare. Yahweh's unique. The nation's coming together. Who's being summoned to worship here? Not people. Who? Trees, rivers, right? And rocks and fields. And sea creatures and fish and so on. So this brings you in. Again, if you've been doing the 90 days, you've come across this theme already. It's a very profound theme in the scriptures that the creation itself speaks a language of worship and praise. And we call it transcendence or beauty, right? So it's the experience that you have when you're seeing a sunset or when you, whatever, go to a aquarium and you see jellyfish. I think jellyfish are the most bizarre creatures on the planet. They're like aliens. They really are. They're like aliens. You know what I'm saying? But they exist. It's very improbable that any of us should exist, much less us, to consider something as strange as a jellyfish. And so, just yesterday, my family, my wife and my little son and I, we took a drive. So my wife's due on Wednesday. She has to like waddle around. She's so pregnant, you know what I'm saying? So we can't go for walks anymore, at least long walks. It's very uncomfortable. So we took a drive. We went up the gorge, up to the Dalles, and then around the back of the mountain. You guys ever done that drive before? And then by Kaneda and so on, and then the back 26. And it's just epic. It's just unbelievable views when you go up those hillsides east of Mount Hood, and you can see Mount Adams and Mount St. Helens. You can see the top of Mount Jefferson. It's just unbelievable. And in the modern world, we're forced to ask this question, of course, is this just the random agglomeration of molecules that just happen to produce creatures who can be aware of such beauty, in which case it's just a happy coincidence? Or is creation itself pointing to something greater, pointing to a mind capable of conceiving of beauty and meaning and transcendence? And that's, of course, that's the core of our conviction here, is that there is a mind, and that mind has identified themselves as Yahweh and come among us as Jesus. And so what our song does is not just tell the good news about what Jesus has done. It doesn't just unite all the families of the earth. It actually unites us to creation itself. Song and poetry in its beauty and transcendence and being like the language of the heart and of the soul, it unites us to the song of creation itself. It gives articulate words to what the trees have been trying to say for much longer than humans have been around, you know what I'm saying? And what the stars have been saying much, much longer than we've we've been around. It's the universal language of beauty and transcendence, and it's pointed at a particular being. And so we're called to join all of creation with our song, not just about the past that he created, but also to express our hope. Look at how the poem ends. This is, might have kind of struck some of us as strange. All of creation is pointing forward, and we join creation in looking forward to what? That the Creator is coming to judge. And some of us were like, oh, that's not very good news, the judge. Because we hear that word judge, especially in religious contexts, and we think negativity and judgmental and so on. But in the scriptures, God's role as a judge is good news. The world is a really screwed up place. Can I get an amen? You don't have to be a Christian to believe that, right? And what's primarily screwed up with the world is us, right? And I hope you're not so naive as to think you're not part of the problem, right? And so what this is good. God's judgment is an expression of his love and his commitment to this beautiful world that he's made. And so we sing both to celebrate the beauty and the meaning of creation as we join it, but also to express, like what Paul said in Romans chapter 8, that creation is longing. It's groaning for its redemption. And so as we sing, we're joining something that's not just international, but it's universal in its praise. Josh White, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I think that Tim just said something as when he asked me if I had something to say that just inspired a memory. Thomas Aquinas tried to actually give sort of technical language to what is beauty. And that's a very difficult thing to define. And one of the things he says that beauty is the proper conformity of the parts to one another and to the whole. And I was going to share that, but then I realized I didn't know what he meant by that. It just sounded really smart until he was speaking. And what I think Aquinas is saying is that there is an ideal and our hearts know it and creation groans for it and that we're moving toward it. And as a kingdom outpost, every time we sing the praises of God and we declare that longing for his return, that come back and judge, make right everything that's broken, is that beauty in its truest meaning cannot come to full fruition until all the parts are working as a harmonious whole. And I think that is a powerful picture because we essentially, what are we as we pray that God would bring his kingdom every day. And what we are is we are a kingdom outpost. We are to reflect what is coming in full in the future. We have Jesus now, but not in the fullest sense of how we will have him in the future. We worship a God who makes the possibility of every moment new. And we sing of that experience of freshness of the Spirit moving in our lives. But we also sing a song of longing, a longing for God to come and to make right all that is wrong. A song that believes that true beauty in its fullest sense, where it won't be an ambiguous longing of the heart, but it'll be something actual and vital and vibrant. It will be our experience for all of eternity. This is the thing that I think it's important to see, is that the psalm begins with God's people singing, then it's the nation singing, then it's the whole world, the whole universe, the cosmos singing. And we, as today, are a continuation of the song that began at the beginning of all things, back in eternity, in the very heart of God. And that song, as it broke forth and creation broke forth, and I love how men like Tolkien and Lewis sort of write that idea of God singing forth creation, Aslan creating Narnia, Tolkien in this Silmarillion. Is that how you say that? The creation account, it's a song sung forth. Creation is sung forth. But as we know, as sin entered into the world, it brought dissonance into that song. It brought an ugliness to the melody, but God is greater than that. And God has been able to take even the dissonance and thread it back into his redemptive story. And when we sing now, we are engaging in this long tradition, and we're bringing our peace to it. As a kingdom outpost, we are singing, we are continuing that longing, come, Lord Jesus, come. In the belief that God is coming back, and we bring our little piece of beauty. We're declaring what will be, and in doing so, there's a hint of it felt right now.
And so when we sing tonight, I just want to encourage you, you aren't singing into the air. You are singing to the one who is more real than you, than your own thoughts, the one who is more real than the thing, the person before you and behind you. You are singing to the one who created you, and he created you to sing. He's commanded you to sing. He's given you the privilege to sing as a means of expressing with the heart what can only really be expressed in the unity of the brothers and sisters through music. We don't speak well all at the same time, but we can sing well all at the same time. And I would encourage...
Can you imagine if we tried to talk aloud all of the songs that we sing?
Oh, it would be really humorous.
Do you guys know the bored monotone voice that when people read things aloud? Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
Just for the last song, just if we were sort of saying, instead of just fun electronic music that some of you were scared by, we're just like, Lord, I need you now. Hey, you're not in time. And here's the good news, too, because some of you are thinking to yourself, I don't sing because I can't sing. Is there anywhere in the psalm that says, sing if you can sing? Or sing if I gave you the gift of song? And you say, well, the Lord didn't give me the gift of a melody. That's actually just part of your sinfulness. No, I'm just joking. But I do think that there is a call. What God is listening to is what? He is listening to the human heart. And we don't have the right to be silent. Jesus said, if you remain silent, the rocks will cry out. If the heavens are worshiping our King, why are we not worshiping him and singing together? So lift up your voice. That's why we have the music loud, so we don't have to hear you if your voice is bad. You don't have any excuse. So the Lord is worth praising. He's worth worshiping. Jesus is coming. And beauty will be understood in all of its fullness when God has set right everything that is wrong. Amen? Let's pray.